This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of people who have never even seen Andre Serrano's work have an opinion about it. Because in 1989, his work, along with the work of Robert Mapplethorpe, was at the center of the debate over federal funding of controversial art. Jesse Helms used Serrano's photograph, Piss Christ, as one of the primary examples of the blasphemous, worthless art the NEA should be prohibited from funding. The photograph shows Jesus on the cross through a yellow haze against a blood-colored background. As several critics have pointed out, if it weren't for the title, you would think the image was reverential and have no idea that it was a crucifix immersed in urine. Much of Serrano's work deals with taboos. His current show at the Paula Cooper Gallery in New York features a series of photographs of bodies taken at a morgue. The New Yorker magazine described these pictures as haunting and moral, having a humanity and grandeur which one expects to see in the paintings of El Greco or Francis Bacon. We want to advise you that we will be discussing subject matter that some listeners might find offensive or disturbing. Andre Serrano told me why he did a series of photos from a morgue.
Most artists, if they're interested in life, and I assume they are also interested in death. To me, it's not an extraordinary thought to want to portray death. A lot of painters have done it throughout history, you know. So, I mean, for me, the question is it always takes me aback, and I don't quite know how to answer it, except to say that, I think everyone is concerned with issues of mortality.
How did you find a morgue that let you take the photographs?
Well, it wasn't easy, but it wasn't hard once I found it. And I think I was just extraordinarily lucky through contacts to find that morgue.
Are you not supposed to say who they were or how you got them?
No, I don't say.
Because they knew it would be controversial that they let you in?
Well, you know, I don't want to draw attention to the fact that, to the specific locale. To me, it's not important.
What were the ground rules for you? Did the people at the morgue say you can do this, but you can't do that?
They told me if a body has not been autopsied and it's a matter of police investigation, then don't touch anything. If there is no autopsy to be done or after the autopsy, you can touch anything you want. Just make sure you wear two pairs of gloves.
So you could arrange the body if you wanted to?
Yeah, but I rarely did that. I mean, the only thing that I really did was I covered up a couple of faces with a blindfold.
Yeah, I was wondering why you did that. And both of those faces, I think, that you covered up were pneumonia victims.
They happened to be pneumonia victims. They were HIV positive. It was actually AIDS, but it was pneumonia that they died of, yes. One woman, I suppose I'm not sure how she got the disease, but I know the man was got it through a blood transfusion.
So why did you cover up the eyes on both of those faces?
Because I thought they would be identifiable without the blindfold.
Oh, I see. Okay, so, I see. What was your process of approaching each body? Were they kind of zipped up in body bags or before?
Sometimes they would come in while I was working there. And, I think as of the second day, I knew more or less what direction I wanted to go in. And that's when I started to use the black backdrop. And my own flash equipment, of course.
Maybe you could describe what your approach was to taking the pictures.
Well, basically, I'm faced with the, formal decision of having to make these people look different when they're essentially all in the same position, lying on their backs. So I had to find for myself new ways of photographing them.
What ways did you try?
Well, initially, I would photograph them pretty much mid-range. That is to say, get the entire, if not the entire body, I would get torsos and large areas of the body into the framing of the picture. Eventually, I decided to focus in on details, and so they became very much close-ups.
What surprised you about your emotional response to viewing dead people?
I suppose what surprised me was the fact that I was fairly cool about it. I remember when I first got there, the pathologist in charge of the morgue who gave me permission to photograph asked me if I had ever seen dead bodies before, and I said, no, never. And he said that, he warned me, he said, some people can take and some can't. And so we went into the morgue, and as soon as I walked in through the door, I saw that there was a child on the autopsy table. She was about 7 or 8 years old, and she had died of chicken pox. And no sooner did I walk in than a doctor took a scalpel, and he opened her from the groin area right up to the neck. And all of a sudden, they just start taking her organs out. And it was very strange. One minute the child was, a human being with an identity, and the next minute she's nothing but me. But once I realized that I could take that, you know, I knew I could take anything, and I just got to work.
You know, one of the many interesting things about your series of photographs is that, well, this kind of art lets us see things that we would never see, and it lets us stare at things that it would be really socially unacceptable or impossible to stare at.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you know, the morgue is, and the idea of death is pretty taboo in many ways, even though we're exposed to it constantly on TV and in other ways. But the morgue itself is a pretty secret arena that very few people enter. And one thing that I notice about this show is no matter how, and it has been strong for certain people, no matter how violent the reaction, although I would think that's the exception to the rule, people are drawn to it and compelled to stay and stare.
Did you ever feel that it was wrong for you to stare or that it was disrespectful to the dead to take their pictures?
Not at all. As an artist, it's a very difficult thing for me to say, you know, that an idea should not be developed for moral reasons. You know, there are very few things that I can think of, and I can't think of any right now, that I could say, that I would say, no, I have to draw the line and stop here.
When I walked into the Paula Cooper Gallery, the first photograph of yours that I saw on the wall was called Hacked to Death. And this photograph is basically one quarter of a person's face, and the eye is at the center of the photograph. The skin is bruised. There's pools of blood that have formed in the recesses of the face. The eye is open, and the eye is reflecting light, but the eye does look dead. Tell me about taking this picture.
He was killed by his wife with a large kitchen knife. She stabbed him about 15 times. And you know, although I didn't think of it, someone has, said that it reminded me of that, it reminded them of that scene in Andalusian Dog, Luis Buñuel's first movie, with the close-up of the eye.
That's the movie in which there's a razor blade that slits an eye open.
Exactly. And at the, you know, when that movie was first shown in the late 20s or 30s, I believe it caused a riot at the movie house.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel queasy or upset taking this one?
Not particularly, no, although he was a mess, you know. I just think that for myself and the people who work there, you know, there has to be some sort of emotional detachment to be able to do the work that you do. People ask me if I ever got upset, and I must say I never got upset about what I was doing. But I do remember at the time that I was going through my own personal changes and getting upset about other things in my life, having nothing to do with the morgue. And now when I think of it, you know, it maybe was some sort of displacement. You know, I know I couldn't afford to let anything come between me and the work I was doing. And so I didn't attribute my, my disturbances, emotional disturbances, to what I was doing.
In this photograph, Hacked to Death, how did you determine which part of the body or the face you wanted to focus on, how you wanted to frame it, what you wanted the photograph to say, basically?
Well, I did frame two different versions of it. And the second version, which I like a lot, but I didn't have room to show it at Paula Cooper Gallery, it essentially is a groin shot. He had white underwear, except he's so bloody that it's almost all red. And, that was another shot that I concentrated on. At that point, when I was photographing that body, you know, I had come to the conclusion that details could tell me more or could be a lot stronger than whole areas. And so I was narrowing in on specific areas.
I guess what I reacted to most in that photo was the eye. We convey who we are so much with our eyes. Our eyes have so much personality. Our eyes register confusion or recognition. And I just found it very interesting to stare into this dead eye.
Mm. You know, to me, yeah, and as you say, it's a dead, lifeless eye, but it's still engaging in some way. And I think that, you know, sometimes I do portraits where I like to engage the sitter with the viewer through the camera, you know? And, that's essentially what happens with that man.
You have a photograph called Fatal Meningitis, and basically it's a photograph of two baby feet, and right above the ankles are sock marks, you know, the kind of like elastic sock marks that you get at the top of where the socks were on your legs. And I was wondering, like, how long this baby had been dead when you took the photograph, and how long sock marks like that stay on a body?
I think that baby was, had been in the morgue a relatively short time, a matter of hours, and those socks had been removed, perhaps a few, half an hour before I took the picture.
Do those sock marks interest you?
A lot of times when I'm shooting, I'm under tight circumstances where I have to do my work very quickly, and so I don't take notice of certain details. A lot of times I familiarize myself with my subjects after I take the picture through the work, and I didn't see those marks at the time until after I finished the photograph.
You have a photograph in your show of a rat poison suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second photo, in Rat Poison Suicide 2, there's a foot protruding from a white body bag, and there's an open slit or wound on the foot. And as I walked through the gallery, I noticed that there were a couple of other bodies that had the same kind of wound. And I really couldn't tell whether this was a kind of wound that came after death or whether several of the bodies you photographed had the same wounds.
Yeah. Now, it was explained to me that those surgical incisions that the doctors make to determine whether or not there's a bruise underneath the skin, because bruises take a few hours, sometimes even longer, to appear on the surface of the skin. And so they make those cuts to see if there's damaged tissue underneath there.
Well, I'll tell you, when I saw those wounds, they looked kind of familiar to me, and they reminded me in a way of certain wounds that I've seen in paintings of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. For me also, it reminds me of the stigmata. And that's why I think that picture in particular assumes a religious persona because of that.
That also made me think about how a lot of biblical imagery is of the dead. Jesus, saints, martyrs?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been drawn to religious themes in the past, and even though this work is not overtly spiritual or religious in nature, I think that you're right, there's a reference to painting, specifically religious painting sometimes.
Religious imagery figures into a lot of your work, including your most famous piece, Piss Christ, which we'll talk about in a little while, but I'm wondering if you grew up in a religious house.
Basically, my mother was Catholic, but she was the sort of woman who was always late, and we would get to Mass about 10 minutes before it ended.
Was that a relief to you, or were you sorry you missed it?
And to her, too, probably.
Uh-huh. So I think your mother was African-Cuban, and your father was from Honduras?
Yes.
So they were Catholic?
They were, actually, but I don't know too much about what my father's religion was because I didn't spend much time with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what kind of religious imagery did you see when you were growing up?
Except for the, it's funny because we didn't have any crucifixes at home. She thought they were kind of morbid, but there was a picture of Jesus, a small picture of Sacred Heart. But the most religious images that I saw were at the Metropolitan Museum of Art when I was about 12 years old and started to go there by myself. That was my first influence, really, my first, endeavor into art.
My guest is artist Andre Serrano. In 1989, his work was at the center of the controversy over public funding of the arts. His show of photos from the morgue closes tomorrow at the Paula Cooper Gallery in New York. More after we take a break. This is Fresh Air. Artist Andre Serrano is my guest. Well, let me ask you about Piss Christ, which is the very controversial work that that you made and that in 1989 helped create that whole controversy about federal funding of controversial art. For our listeners who've only heard about this piece but have never seen it, would you describe Piss Christ?
Basically, it's a crucifix bathed in a murky yellow light. And it's a very mysterious image. I think, as many people have pointed out, without the title, it would have been seen as a very reverential treatment of the crucifix, and fit to hang in a church, probably.
This was a photograph.
Yes.
But the crucifix was actually immersed in urine.
Yes.
Yours.
Yes.
What was the idea behind the piece?
Well, basically, I had been doing religious imagery before Piss Christ, and then I realized that I was concentrating a lot on photographing dead animals and using a lot of blood in my work, and so I decided to reduce and simplify my imagery. And I did that by concentrating on using only blood and milk. And at some point, you know, I felt like I had to add piss to my palette. Otherwise, I'd just be making, red and white pictures forever. So, Piss Quest is essentially, initially the fluid pictures were about abstraction, and eventually when I decided to refer back to some sort of representation, Piss Christ was a very natural image for me to make, because it was a way of combining two different directions in my work in one image.
The body fluid direction and the religious imagery direction?
Yes.
Now, when you put those two together, a lot of people see it as blasphemous.
Well, you know, I never saw it that way, and I remember when I first showed the work in New York, that this woman, she was married to a reverend. She said to me, you know, when it comes to religion, my husband and I don't agree about anything, but we were both very moved by your picture. And, that essentially was the reaction at first. No one, paid much mind to Piss Christ, except after, the American Family Association got into the picture more than 2 years after the picture was first made.
What were you saying about religion in that piece?
Well, I would say that, Piss Christ is probably a reflection of my own ambivalent feelings about my Catholic upbringing. Aside from that, there's nothing specific. All sorts of, claims have been made for that piece. And I remember at the time that I was embroiled in the controversy, the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, which was the sponsor of that very controversial grant and art show, said to me, the NEA is breathing down our necks for an explanation of Piss Christ, and, can we say it's a, protest against the commercialization of religion and religious values? And I said, that's not language that I would use, but, if you want to say that's fine. At this point in my life, first of all, I'm sort of tired of Piss Christ. And also, I feel like the less said about the picture, the better, because I don't feel the need to defend it.
How did you choose which crucifix to use?
By that point, I had a large collection of crucifixes, which I still have. And I just went in the room and chose one.
What was it like for you to be at the center of a national controversy, to have your art addressed on the Senate floor?
It was very strange. I mean, at first I couldn't believe it when they first told me that this was going on, that, thousands of people, at the request of the American Family Association were sending in protest letters to Congress. And then I saw myself being denounced, on TV and in the congressional record by all these people who never could spell my name right. I remember in one entry in the congressional record in May of 1989, I think three or four senators referred to me, and they all remarkably spelled my name differently and all wrong.
How politicized had you been about the arts, First Amendment issues, funding of the arts?
Not very. And I'm not very politicized as far as that's concerned. I remember, during and after the controversy, people would ask me to come lecture on censorship, And I always declined to do that. I declined to be on panels. I feel I will lecture, on my work, but I'm not a crusader of any sort,
Jesse Helms led the crusade against your work and against federal funding of controversial art. He said that he had never met you, but he was sure you were not an artist, you were a jerk. Have you met him since he said that?
No, but I came close. One time I was in Atlanta, and he was due to speak at a Baptist church down there. And then, all these artists mounted a protest the morning that he was supposed to appear. And so they sent word that he couldn't make it because the budget was out of control, and he had to stay in Washington or something. And so he never came, but I had actually bought my ticket to see him.
What most angered you, and what did you find most absurd or amusing about how political people discussed your art?
I don't know. I think the most remarkable thing for me was, he made it seem like, he said something about that I was taunting the American public or the American people. And I mean, that was, to me, a remarkable image in my head, like I was standing there single-handedly taunting the American public, you know. It was incredible. I must say, though, it hurt me a lot, you know. I mean, even though everyone thinks Jesse Helms is a jerk, you know. I mean, I took it personal.
Why did you take it personally?
I don't know. He was saying nasty things about me.
It was that the first time that that had happened to you, that somebody was saying nasty things about you because of your art?
Absolutely.
Do you think that the controversy about Piss Christ ended up bringing you a larger audience that you had before? I mean, let's face it, at most galleries, the people who show up are people who are already in or interested in the art world. And once this became a national issue, I imagine a lot of curious people who don't usually go to galleries showed up to see your work.
No question about it. And for me, I mean, you know, the collectors also came in droves, and that was nice, too. But for me, it's most refreshing and satisfying when I get people, people who don't normally go to art shows, who go to my show, shows. I mean, at Paula Cooper Gallery, they've had, many, many calls from people asking how much does it cost to get in. And these are obviously not your usual art clientele and public, but they come to the show.
Jesse Helms wanted to hurt art like yours. Do you think he inadvertently helped you a lot?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I helped him in some ways, and he helped me. You know, he got reelected, and, I became who I am.
Some people say that it's just impossible to shock audiences anymore with art. Now, a lot of people claimed to be shocked by some of your art. Are you interested in shocking people?
No, you know, and I think the most provocative art is art that does not try to be provocative. I think when you try to shock, it usually doesn't work, you know. It's when you're not trying that it may happen.
And yet you're very interested in taboos, you know, taking pictures of dead animals, taking pictures of dead people in the morgue.
I am, yes.
So why are you interested in taboos?
Why not? I think someone has to do the work that I do, and I think by examining these taboos, eventually they become less of a taboo. You know, during Victorian times, taking pictures of dead people was not a taboo. People would take the photographs of their loved ones in their arms sometimes who were deceased. And the idea of death was not threatening to most people. And I think, at some point in the future, maybe death won't be such a taboo anymore either.
Artist Andre Serrano, his show of photographs from the morgue closes tomorrow at the Paula Cooper Gallery in Manhattan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Andre Serrano will be back with us in the second part of our show. This is Fresh Air. We're back with artist Andre Serrano. In 1989, his art was at the center of the debate over public funding of controversial art. Some people have found his new show disturbing. Many find it very moving and thought-provoking. The show features his photographs of dead bodies taken at a morgue. In a little while, we'll discuss a turning point in Serrano's life that led him toward art about taboos. First, let's hear about his 1990 series of photographs of homeless people called Nomads. He took their portraits in a makeshift studio he set up in a New York subway station. He told me about the inspiration behind the series.
I was inspired by Edward Curtis's portraits of the American Indians at the turn of the century. And Curtis felt he was photographing a vanishing race. And some people, you know, to this day have a problem with Curtis's images because they feel he used his models and gave them robes and props that they didn't ordinarily have. But I defend his work because I remember growing up in the 50s when the only other images that I ever saw of the American Indian was his savages on television. So I much prefer Curtis's heroic portraits.
So did you try to pose homeless people in a heroic way?
I probably did, you know. And someone once said to me, oh, you've given these people so much dignity. And I answered, you know, I've not given these people any dignity that they didn't already have. I just brought it out.
So what kind of studio did you set up in the subway? What was it like?
It was a gray background and my flash equipment and a stool and a tripod and camera.
Did any police ever try to stop you? It's against the law to do nearly anything on a subway platform.
Absolutely. And the police were much better than the transit authority inspectors who, you know, would literally, you know, block my camera and threaten me. The police on occasion would say, okay, finish up and then you have to go. And they were very nice.
You paid each person who sat for you. How much did you pay them?
I paid them $10 for about 15 minutes work. And I know people think, oh, $10 doesn't sound like much. But I would photograph about 7 or 8 people a night. I would pay the two friends who helped me about $50. So every time I went out, it cost me about $140, maybe $150. And I went out maybe 20 or 30 times. So I stopped doing the work when I couldn't afford to do it anymore.
Do you know, were you able to ever show the photos to people who you photographed? Were you able to find them afterwards? Did you try?
At some point, three of the people that I photographed actually found, you know, heard about the show and went to see it. And, you know, I've been told that they were very pleased with their portraits. Not so long ago, just before Christmas, someone called me up on my machine at home and left a message saying, my name is Renee, and, you know, you took my picture about 2 years ago, and it was in Mirabella, and, you know, people all over saw it, and I wanted to talk to you, maybe get a small print or something. So, you know, we got together, and, yeah, Renee said he was at a very low point in his life at that point. He had been to college, and then people start to see his picture, and they call his mother's house, and, you know, people as far away as Switzerland called his mother, and they want to know, what is happening with Renee? And somehow Renee, it was a turning point in his life, and he started to get himself together. And he's actually working right now as as a counselor for a homeless project in the Port Authority. And he has a nice little office, and I gave him a print to hang up.
That's interesting. Now, I know that you stopped making art for about 7 years, during which period you were doing a lot of drugs. I know that period of your life ended about 12 years ago, from what I've read. I couldn't help but wonder if you were ever homeless during that period.
I was never homeless, but I used to, you know, spend a lot of time on the streets, because when you do drugs, you just spend a lot of time out there. So, you know, for me, there was not that comfortable distance, say, if I was a white person photographing homeless people, you know. I mean, I often walk down the street and see people, you know, see people that remind me of people that I used to hang out with, or sometimes even on an occasion, I see people that I do know from way back then. And I often wonder why them and why not me, you know.
Did that have something to do with your interest in doing this series?
Absolutely, yeah.
So how did you end that period of your life of doing drugs?
Well, basically, when I turned 28, you know, I felt that, I had gone to art school when I was much younger, when I was 17, 18, and I felt that I always knew that I was going to be an artist. And at the age of 28, I just felt myself, I felt my biological clock telling me that if I didn't stop doing drugs, you know, soon, I would not ever become the artist that I felt I was. And so I immediately stopped, you know. And getting to the point where I weaned myself completely off drugs was not easy. But once I got there, I never looked back, you know.
Now, how did your art change when you started making it again?
Well, I didn't start making it again for about 2 or 3 years, after I stopped doing any drugs. And I would say that, I can't say exactly how it changed. But obviously, you know, the life that I led has informed my work in some way. That, it, you know, if I had just come straight out of art school and done work, it would have probably been a lot different than it is now.
That's interesting. What are some of the ways you think your art was changed by that period?
I think, I am drawn to subjects that are bordering on the unacceptable because I, for so long, lived, you know, an unacceptable life, you know. I'm actually surprised that I have a legitimate and socially redeeming function in life at this point because for so long I didn't.
Do you feel comfortable in the gallery world?
I do, and I don't. I mean, I feel comfortable because I'm part of it. But there's always, you know, there was the feeling that, I had one foot out and one foot in. And to this day, you know, I'm not totally ensconced in the art world, you know. But I think that's good, you know. It makes me struggle harder.
Artist Andres Serrano is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Artist Andres Serrano is my guest. Lots of artists end up with descriptive labels in front of their names. Yours has been, since 1989, controversial or profane. But it's interesting, it hasn't been Latino. Do you know what I mean? People don't think of you as an artist who defines himself by his ethnic background.
Yeah, I suppose if I had to choose between one or the other, I'd choose the first, because I have, you know, for many years, even though I have a Hispanic background, done the sort of work that is not labeled Latino. And to me, that's very gratifying because it's a lot more universal than that, I think. And, you know, it's nice that I don't think of, you know, they don't think of me when they want a token Latino in a show. That's nice. I can do without that.
Mm-hmm. You're interested in religious art, and what kind of art do you have in your home? Do you have much art in your house?
I've got a few photographs, one by George Platt Lines, who, you know, without Lines, there wouldn't be any Robert Mapplethorpe. He did a lot of male nudes. My picture is one of a dance production that he did. I've got one of James Van Der Zee, probably the best-known black studio photographer in America. I've got a photograph by Edward Curtis that is actually a photograph and not a photogravure. I've got some photogravures by him also. And I also have a Baron von Gloden, who he's a very curious figure in photography, certainly on the edge, who photographed all these young boys, dressing them as little Roman, boys at the turn of the century. And I also have a plaque by Jenny Holzer, a print by Ross Bleckner, and, one or two other things.
You told us before that you had a collection of crucifixes. Do you still have that collection?
I do, yes.
What else do you collect? What other kind of objects do you have in your house?
Mostly old things. I love antiques. I love to go, you know, whenever I'm in a different city, even when I'm here, I always go to flea markets, and I like to buy old things, and, you know, that's, yeah.
I've read that you also have like a human brain in a jar.
Yeah, I've got two of them, actually. Yeah, two.
Is that from the from the morgue?
No, it's not. It's from a friend of mine who's got a store uptown, Maxillomandible.
What does your friend sell in the store?
He sells bones and skulls. Henry used to work at the Museum of Natural History, and he's got a little store that is practically like a little museum in itself.
This might be too personal, so feel free not to answer it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd read that your mother was hospitalized several times for psychosis.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel that your visions, the visions from which your art comes from, were psychotic or crazy?
Not at all. But, you know, when I was a kid, I was always terrified that people would find out that she had psychotic episodes. And I wanted to put as much distance between myself and any semblance of insanity. But it's funny, you know, at some point in my life, I guess because I am an artist and because I've, you know, due to the controversy, done so many lectures where I've had to accept who I am and publicly explain what I am, you know. And so the insanity for me is no longer a threat, you know. I think we're all kind of crazy. It's okay.
Your show at the Paula Cooper Gallery is closing Sunday. What kind of feelings do you have when a show is about to close?
Actually, it closes Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you know, I get really sad, you know. I think it's called the, post-exhibition depression.
Is the show going to be booked into another gallery, do you know?
The show is actually going to a museum in the south of France in March, and then to another museum in the north of France in May, and then possibly to another museum in Brussels.
Are people buying the photos? And I'm wondering if, like, individual collectors will hang it in their homes, or...
You know, a lot of people ask me that, and it's very simple. I mean, I've not asked Paula anything about sales because I don't want to know, you know. I know that, you know, when she gets paid, I get paid. So, you know, if I don't know the answer, then I can't tell you either.
So why don't you want to know?
Oh, because, you know, first of all, if I know, then people will ask me, and then I have to say, yes, they're selling very well, and people look at you, you know, funny. And if you say, no, they're not selling, then people look at you funny again. So it's better not to say anything.
Andre Serrano, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Artist Andre Serrano. This is Fresh Air.